and I don't know why. He looked down at his hands, pink and clean on the stone. There are few men with more blood on their hands than me. None that I know of. The Bloody Nine, they call me, my enemies. And there's a lot of them. Always more enemies and fewer friends. Blood gets you nothing but more blood. It follows me now always like my shadow. And like my shadow, I can never be free of it. I should never be free of it. I've earned it. I've deserved it. I've sought it out. Such is my punishment. And that was all. Logan breathed a deep, ragged sigh and stared out at the lake. He couldn't bring himself to look at the man beside him, didn't want to see the expression on his face. Who wants to learn he's keeping company with the Bloody Nine, a man who's wrought more death than the plague and with less regret? They could never be friends now, not with all those corpses between them. Then he felt Kwai's hand clap him on the shoulder. "Well, there it is," he said, grinning from ear to ear. "But you saved me, and I'm right grateful for it." "I've saved a man this year and only killed four. I'm born again." And they both laughed for a while, and it felt good. "So, Malachus, I see you are back with us." They turned, Kwai stumbling on his blanket and looking a touch sick. The first of the Magi was standing in the doorway, dressed in a long white shirt with sleeves rolled up to the elbow. He still looked more like a butcher than a wizard to Logan.
"Master Byers, I was just coming to see you," stuttered Kwai.
"Indeed. How fortunate for us both, then, that I have come to you." The Magus stepped out onto the balcony. "It occurs to me that a man who is well enough to talk and laugh and venture out of doors is doubtless well enough to read and study and expand his tiny mind. What would you say to that?"
"Doubtless."
"Doubtless, yes. Tell me, how are your studies progressing?"
The wretched apprentice looked utterly confused.
"They have been somewhat interrupted."
"You made no progress with Juven's Principles of Art while you were lost in the hills in bad weather?"
No progress, no."
"And your knowledge of the histories, did that develop far while Master Ninefingers was carrying you back to the library?"
I must confess, it didn't."
"Your exercises and meditations, though, surely you have been practicing those while unconscious this past week?"
"Well, no, the unconsciousness was,
So, tell me, would you say that you are ahead of the game, so to speak, or have your studies fallen behind?"
Kwai stared down at the floor.
"They were behind when I left."
"Then perhaps you could tell me where you plan to spend the day."
The apprentice looked up hopefully.
"At my desk?"
"Excellent!" Byers smiled wide. "I was about to suggest it, but you have anticipated me. Your keenness to learn does you much credit."
Kwai nodded furiously and hurried towards the door, the hem of his blanket trailing on the flags.
"Bethod is coming," murmured Byers. "He will be here today."
Logan's smile vanished. His throat felt suddenly tight. He remembered their last meeting well enough. Stretched out on his face on the floor of Bethod's hall at Carleon, beaten and broken and well chained up, dribbling blood into the straw, and hoping the end wouldn't be too long coming. Then, no reason given, they'd let him go. Flung him out the gates with the Dog Man, Three Trees, the Weakest, and the rest, and told him never to come back, never. The first time Bethod ever showed a grain of mercy, and the last, Logan didn't doubt.
"Today?"
he asked, trying to keep his voice even.
"Yes, and soon. The King of the Northmen. Ha! The arrogance of him!"
Byers glanced sidelong at Logan. He is coming to ask me for a favour, and I would like you to be there.
He won't like that.
Exactly.
The wind felt colder than before. If Logan never saw Bethod again, it would be far too soon. But some things have to be done. It's better to do them than to live with the fear of them. That's what Logan's father would have said. So he took a deep breath and squared his shoulders.
I'll be there.
Excellent. Then there is but one thing missing.
What?
Baez smirked.
You need a weapon.
It was dry in the cellars beneath the library, dry and dark and very, very confusing. They'd gone up and down steps, around corners, past doors, taking here or there a turning to the left or right. The place was a warren. Logan hoped he didn't lose sight of the wizard's flickering torch, or he could easily be stuck beneath the library forever.
Dry down here, nice and dry,
Baez was saying to himself, voice echoing down the passageway and merging with their flapping footfalls.
There's nothing worse than damp for books.
He pulled up suddenly next to a heavy door.
Or for weapons.
He gave the door a gentle shove, and it swung silently open.
Look at that. Hasn't been open for years, but the hinges still move smooth as butter. That's craftsmanship for you. Why does no one care about craftsmanship anymore?
Baez stepped over the threshold without waiting for an answer, and Logan followed close behind. The wizard's torch lit up a long, low hall with walls of rough stone blocks, the far end lost in shadows. The room was lined with racks and shelves, the floor littered with boxes and stands, everything heaped and bursting with a mad array of arms and armour. Blades and spikes and polished surfaces of wood and metal caught the flickering torchlight as Baez paced slowly across the stone floor, weaving between the weapons and casting around.
Quite a collection, muttered Logan as he followed the Magus through the clutter. A load of old junk, mostly. But there should be a few things worth the finding.
Baez took a helmet from a suit of ancient gilded plate armour and looked it over with a frown.
What do you make of that?
I've never been much for armour.
No, you don't strike me as the type. All very well on horseback, I dare say, but it's a pain in the arse when you've a journey to make on foot.
He tossed the helmet back onto its stand, then stood there staring at the armour, lost in thought.
Once you've got it on, how do you piss?
Logan frowned. He said, but Baez was already moving off down the room and taking the light with him.
You must have used a few weapons in your time, Master Ninefingers. What's your preference for?
I've never really had one, said Logan, ducking under a rusty halberd leaning out from a rack. A champion never knows what he might be called on to fight with.
Of course, of course.
Baez took up a long spear with a vicious barbed head and wafted it around a bit. Logan stepped back cautiously.
Deadly enough. You could keep a man at bay with one of these. But a man with a spear needs a lot of friends, and they all need spears as well.
Baez shoved it back on the rack and moved on.
This looks fearsome.
The Magus took hold of the gnarled shaft of a huge double-bladed axe.
Shit,
he said as he lifted it up, veins bulging out of his neck.
It's heavy enough.
He set it down with a thump, making the rack wobble.
You could kill a man with that. You could cut him clean in half if he was standing still.
This is better, said Logan.
It was a simple, solid-looking sword in a scabbard of weathered brown leather.
Oh, yes, indeed. Much, much better. That blade is the work of Canadius, the master maker himself.
Baez handed his torch to Logan and took the long sword from the rack.
Has it ever occurred to you, Master Ninefingers, that a sword is different from other weapons? Axes and maces and so forth are lethal enough, but they hang on the belt like dumb brutes.
He ran an eye over the hilt,
plain cold metal scored with faint grooves for a good grip, glinting in the torchlight. But a sword has a voice. Eh? Sheathed, it has little to say, to be sure, but you need only put your hand on the hilt, and it begins to whisper in your enemy's ear.
He wrapped his fingers tightly round the grip.
A gentle warning, a word of caution. Do you hear it?
Logan nodded slowly.
Now, murmured Byers, compare it to the sword half-drawn.
A foot length of metal hissed out of the sheath, a single silver letter shining near the hilt. The blade itself was dull, but its edge had a cold and frosty glint.
It speaks louder, does it not? It hisses a dire threat. It makes a deadly promise. Do you hear it?
Logan nodded again, his eye fastened on that glittering edge.
Now compare it to the sword full drawn.
Byers whipped the long blade from its sheath with a faint ringing sound, brought it up so that the point hovered inches from Logan's face.
It shouts now, does it not? It screams defiance. It bellows a challenge. Do you hear it?
Hmm, said Logan, leaning back and staring slightly cross-eyed at the shining point of the sword. Byers let it drop and slid it gently back into its scabbard, something to Logan's relief.
Yes, a sword has a voice. Axes and maces and so forth are lethal enough, but a sword is a subtle weapon and suited to a subtle man. You, I think, Master Ninefingers, are subtler than you appear.
Logan frowned as Byers held the sword out to him. He had been accused of many things in his life, but never subtlety.
Consider it a gift. My thanks for your good manners.
Logan thought about it a moment. He hadn't owned a proper weapon since before he crossed the mountains, and he wasn't keen to take one up again. But Bethod was coming, and soon. Better to have it and not want it than to want it and not have it. Far, far better. You have to be realistic about these things.
Thank you, said Logan, taking the sword from Byers and handing him back the torch. I think.
A small fire crackled in the grate, and the room was warm and homely and comfortable. But Logan didn't feel comfortable. He stood by the window, staring down into the courtyard below, nervous and twitchy and scared, like he used to be before a fight. Bethod was coming. He was somewhere out there, on the road through the woods, or passing between the stones, or across the bridge, or through the gate. The first of the Magi didn't seem tense. He sat comfortably in his chair, his feet up on the table next to a long wooden pipe, leafing through a small white-bound book, with a faint smile on his face. No one had ever looked calmer, and that only made Logan feel worse.
"Is it good?" asked Logan.
"Is what good?"
"The book."
"Oh, yes, it is the best of books. It is Juven's Principles of Art, the very cornerstone of my order."
Byers waved his free hand at the shelves which covered two walls and the hundreds of other identical books lined neatly upon them.
It's all the same. One book.
One.
Logan's eyes scanned across the thick white spines.
That's a pretty damn long book. Have you read it all?
Byers chuckled.
Oh, yes. Many times. Every one of my order must read it and eventually make their own copy.
He turned the book around so that Logan could see. The pages were thickly covered with lines of neat but unintelligible symbols.
I wrote these long ago.
You should read it too.
I'm really not much of a reader.
No?
Asked Byers.
Shame.
He flicked over the page and carried on.
What about that one?
There was another book, sat alone on its side on the very top of one of the shelves, a large black book, scarred and battered-looking, That written by this Juvens as well?
Byers frowned up at it.
No, his brother wrote that.
He got up from his chair, stretched up, and pulled it down.
This is a different kind of knowledge.
He dragged open his desk drawer, slid the black book inside, and slammed it shut.
Best left alone, he muttered, sitting back down and opening up the principles of art again.
Logan took a deep breath, put his left hand on the hilt of the sword, felt the cold metal pressing into his palm. The feel of it was anything but reassuring. He let go and turned back to the window, frowning down into the courtyard. He felt his breath catch in his throat.
Bethard, he's here.
Good, good, muttered Byers absently. Who does he have with him?
Logan peered at the three figures in the courtyard.
Scale, he said with a scowl.
And a woman. I don't recognize her. They're dismounting.
Logan licked his dry lips.
They're coming in.
Yes, yes, murmured Byers. That is how one gets to a meeting. Try to calm yourself, my friend. Breathe.
Logan leaned back against the whitewashed plaster, arms folded, and took a deep breath. It didn't help. The hard knot of worry in his chest only pressed harder. He could hear heavy footsteps in the corridor outside. The doorknob turned. Scale was the first into the room. Bethod's eldest son had always been burly, even as a boy, but since Logan last saw him, he'd grown monstrous. His rock of a head seemed almost an afterthought on top of all that brawn, his skull a good deal narrower than his neck. He had a great block of jaw, a flat stub of a nose, and furious, bulging, arrogant little eyes. His thin mouth was twisted in a constant sneer, much like his younger brother Calder's, but there was less guile here and a lot more violence. He had a heavy broadsword on his hip, and his meaty hand was never far from it as he glowered at Logan, oozing malice from every pore. The woman came next. She was very tall, slender, and pale, almost ill-looking. Her slanting eyes were as narrow and cold as scales were bulging and wrathful, and were surrounded with a quantity of dark paint, which made them look narrower and colder still. There were golden rings on her long fingers, golden bracelets on her thin arms, golden chains around her white neck. She swept the room with her frosty blue eyes, each thing she noticed seeming to lift her to new heights of disgust and contempt. First the furniture, then the books, particularly Logan, and Byers most of all. The self-styled King of the Northmen came last, and more magnificent than ever, robed in rich coloured cloth and rare white furs. He wore a heavy golden chain across his shoulders, a golden circlet round his head, set with a single diamond, big as a bird's egg. His smiling face was more deeply lined than Logan remembered, his hair and beard touched with grey, but he was no less tall, no less vigorous, no less handsome, and he'd gained much of authority and wisdom, of majesty even. He looked every inch a great man, a wise man, a just man. He looked every inch a king. But Logan knew better.
"Bethod," said Byers warmly, snapping his book shut, "my old friend. You can hardly imagine what a joy it is to see you again."
He swung his feet off the table and gestured at the golden chain, the flashing diamond.
"And to see you so hugely advanced in the world. I remember the time was you were happy to visit me alone. But I suppose great men must be attended on, and I see you have brought some other people. Your charming son, I know, of course. I see that you've been eating well at least, eh, Scale?"
"Prince Scale," rumbled Bethod's monstrous son, his eyes popping out even more.
Said Byers, with an eyebrow raised. "I have not had the pleasure of meeting your other companion before."
"I am Cowrib,"
Logan blinked. The woman's voice was the most beautiful thing he'd ever heard. Calming, soothing, intoxicating.
"I am a sorceress,"
she sang, tossing her head with a scornful smile.
"A sorceress from the utmost north."
Logan stood frozen, his mouth half open. His hatred seeped away. They were all friends here, more than friends. He couldn't take his eyes from her, didn't want to. The others in the room had faded. It was as if she was speaking only to him, and the fondest wish of his heart was that she should never stop. But Baez only laughed.
"A real sorceress, and you have the golden voice. How wonderful! It's a long time since I heard that one. But it will not serve you here."
Logan shook his head clear, and his hatred rushed back in, hot and reassuring.
"Tell me, does one have to study to become a sorceress, or is it simply a question of jewelry and a deal of paint about the face?"
Kaurib's eyes narrowed to deadly blue slits, but the first of the Magi didn't give her time to speak.
"And from the utmost north, imagine that!"
He shivered slightly.
"It must be cold up there this time of year. Rough on the nipples, eh? Have you come to us for the warm weather, or is there something else?"
"I go where my king commands,"
she hissed, pointed chin lifting a little higher.
"Your king?"
asked Byers, staring about the room as though there must be someone else there hiding in the corner.
"My father is king of the Northmen now," snarled Scale.
He sneered at Logan.
"You should kneel to him, Bloody Nine,"
he sneered at Byers.
"And so should you, old man."
The first of the Magi spread his hands in apology.
"Oh, I'm afraid I don't kneel to anyone. Too old for it. Stiffness in the joints, you see."
Scale's boot thumped heavy on the floor as he began to move forward, a curse half out of his mouth, but his father placed a gentle hand on his arm.
"Come now, my son, there is no need for kneeling here."
His voice was cold and even as freshly fallen snow.
"It is not fitting that we bicker. Are our interests not the same? Peace? Peace in the north? I have come only to ask for your wisdom, Baez, as I did in days past. Is it so wrong to seek the help of an old friend?"
No one had ever sounded more genuine, more reasonable, more trustworthy. But Logan knew better.
"But do we not have peace in the north already?"
Baez leaned back in his chair, hands clasped before him.
"Are the feuds not all ended? Were you not the victor? Do you not have everything you wanted and more? King of the Northmen, eh? What help could I possibly offer you?"
"I only share my counsel with friends, Baez, and you have been no friend to me of late. You turn away my messengers, my son even. You play host to my sworn enemies."
He frowned towards Logan, and his lip curled.
"Do you know what manner of thing this is? The Bloody Nine? An animal! A coward! An oath-breaker! Is that the kind of company that you prefer?"
Bethod smiled a friendly smile as he turned back to Baez, but there was no missing the threat in his words.
"I fear the time has come for you to decide whether you are with me or against me. There can be no middle ground in this. Either you are a part of my future, or a relic of the past. Yours is the choice, my friend."
Logan had seen Bethod give such choices before. Some men had yielded, the rest had gone back to the mud. But Baez, it seemed, was not to be rushed.
"Which shall it be?"
He reached forward slowly and took his pipe from the table.
"The future or the past?"
He strolled over to the fire and squatted down, back turned to his three guests, took a stick from the grate, set it to the bowl, and puffed slowly away. It seemed to take an age for him to get the damn thing lit.
"With or against?"
he mused as he returned to his chair.
Well?
Demanded Bethod. Byers stared up at the ceiling and blew out a thin stream of yellow smoke. Caurib looked the old Magus up and down with icy contempt. Scale twitched with impatience. Bethod waited, eyes a little narrowed. Finally, Byers gave a heavy sigh.
Very well. I am with you.
Bethod smiled wide, and Logan felt a lurch of terrible disappointment. He had hoped for better from the first of the Magi. Damn foolish, how he never learned to stop hoping.
Good, murmured the King of the Northmen. I knew you would see my way of thinking in the end.
He slowly licked his lips, like a hungry man watching good food brought in.
I mean to invade Angland.
Byers raised an eyebrow. Then he started to chuckle. Then he thumped the table with his fist.
Oh, that's good. That's very good. You find peace does not suit your kingdom, eh, Bethod? The clans are not used to being friends, are they? They hate each other and they hate you, am I right?
Well, smiled Bethod, they are somewhat restive.
I bet they are. But send them to war with the Union, then they will be a nation, eh? United against the common enemy, to be sure. And if you win, you'll be the man who did the impossible, the man who drove the damned Southerners out of the North. You'll be loved, or at any rate, more feared than ever. If you lose, well, at least you keep the clans busy a while and sap their strength in the process. I remember now why I used to like you. An excellent plan.
Bethod looked smug. Of course, and we will not lose. The Union is soft, arrogant, unprepared. With your help.
My help?
Interrupted Byers.
You presume too much.
But you...
Oh, that.
The Magus shrugged.
I am a liar.
Byers lifted his pipe to his mouth. There was a moment of stunned silence. Then Bethod's eyes narrowed. Caurib's widened. Scale's heavy brow crinkled with confusion. Logan's smile slowly returned.
A liar,
hissed the sorceress.
And more besides, say I.
Her voice still had the singing note about it, but it was a different song now. Hard, shrill, murderous sharp.
You old worm, hiding here behind your walls and your servants and your books. Your time is long past, fool. You are nothing but words and dust.
The first of the Magi calmly pursed his lips and blew out smoke.
Words and dust, old worm. Well, we shall see. We will come to your library.
The wizard set his pipe carefully down on the table, a little smoke still curling up out of the bowl.
We will come back to your library and put your walls to the hammer, your servants to the sword, and your books to the fire, to the...
Silence!
Byers was frowning now, deeper even than he had at Calder days before in the yard outside. Again Logan felt the desire to step away, but stronger by far. He found himself glancing around the room for a place to hide. Caurib's lips still moved, but only a meaningless croak came out.
"Break my walls, would you?"
murmured Byers. His grey brows drew inwards, deep, hard grooves cutting into the bridge of his nose.
"Kill my servants, will you?"
asked Byers. The room had turned very chill, despite the logs on the fire.
"Burn my books, say you?"
thundered Byers.
"You say too much, witch!"
Caurib's knees buckled. Her white hand clawed at the doorframe, chains and bangles jingling together as she slumped against the wall.
"Words and dust, am I?"
Byers thrust up four fingers.
"Four gifts you had of me, Bethod. The sun in winter, A storm in summer, and two things you could never have known but for my art. What have you given me in return, eh? This lake and this valley, which were mine already, and but one other thing."
Bethod's eyes flicked across to Logan, then back.
"You owe me still, yet you send messengers to me? You make demands? You presume to command me? That is not my idea of manners."
Scale had caught up now, and his eyes were near popping out of his head.
"Manners? What does a king need with manners? A king takes what he wants."
And he took a heavy step towards the table. Now Scale was big enough and cruel enough to be sure. Most likely you could never find a better man for kicking someone once he was down. But Logan wasn't down, not yet, and he was good and sick of listening to this bloated fool. He stepped forward to block Scale's path, resting his hand on the hilt of his sword.
"Far enough!"
The prince looked Logan over with his bulging eyes, held up his meaty fist, squeezing his great fingers so the knuckles turned white.
"Don't tempt me, Nine Fingers, you broken cur. Your day's long past. I could crush you like an egg."
"You can try it, but I've no mind to let you. You know my work. One step more, and I'll set to work on you, you fucking swollen pig."
"Scale," snapped Bethod. "There is nothing for us here. That much is plain. We are leaving."
The hulking prince locked his great lump of a jaw, his huge hands clenching and unclenching by his sides, glowering at Logan with the most bestial hatred imaginable. Then he sneered and slowly backed away. Byers leaned forward.
"You said you would bring peace to the north, Bethod. And what have you done?
You have piled war on war. The land is bled white with your pride and your brutality. King of the Northmen? Ha! You're not worth the helping. And to think I had such high hopes for you."
Bethod only frowned, his eyes as cold as the diamond on his forehead.
"You have made an enemy of me, Byers. And I am a bad enemy to have, the very worst. You will yet regret this day's work."
He turned his scorn on Logan.
"As for you, Nine Fingers, you will have no more mercy from me. Every man in the north will be your enemy now. You will be hated and hunted and cursed wherever you go. I will see to it."
Logan shrugged. There was nothing new there. Byers stood up from his chair.
"You've said your piece. Now take your witch and get you gone."
Carib stumbled from the room first, still gasping for air. Scale gave Logan one last scowl, then he turned and lumbered away. The so-called King of the Northmen was the last to leave, nodding slowly and sweeping the room with a deadly glare. As their footsteps faded down the corridor, Logan took a deep breath, steadied himself, and let his hand drop from the hilt of the sword.
"So," said Byers brightly, "that went well."
Chapter 14. A Road Between Two Dentists. Past midnight, and it was dark in the middle way. Dark, and it smelled bad. It always smelled bad down by the docks. Old salt water, rotten fish, tar and sweat and horse shit. In a few hours' time, this street would be thronging with noise and activity. Tradesmen shouting, labourers cursing under their loads, merchants hurrying to and fro, 100 carts and wagons rumbling over the dirty cobbles. There would be an endless tide of people, thronging off the ships and thronging on, people from every part of the world, words shouted in every language under the sun. But at night it was still, still and silent.
Silent as the grave, and even worse smelling.
It's down here, said Severard, strolling towards the shadowy mouth of a narrow alley wedged in between two looming warehouses.
Did he give you much trouble?
Asked Glockter as he shuffled painfully after.
Not too much.
The practical adjusted his mask, letting some air in behind.
Must get very clammy under there, all that breath and sweat. No wonder practicals tend to have bad tempers.
He gave Rue's mattress some trouble, stabbed it all to bits. Then Frost knocked him on the head. Funny thing, when that boy knocks a man on the head, the trouble all goes out of him.
What about Ruth?
Still alive. The light from Severard's lamp passed over a pile of putrid rubbish. Glockter heard rats squeaking in the darkness as they scurried away.
You know all the best neighbourhoods, don't you, Severard?
That's what you pay me for, Inquisitor. His dirty black boots squelched heedless into the stinking mush. Glockter limped gingerly around it, holding the hem of his coat up in his free hand.
I grew up round here, continued the practical. Folk don't ask questions.
Except for us. We always have questions.
Ghosts, Severard gave a muffled giggle.
We're the Inquisition. His lamp picked out a dented iron gate, the high wall above topped with rusty spikes.
This is it.
Indeed. And what an auspicious-looking address it is. The gate evidently didn't see much use. Its brown hinges squealed in protest as the practical unlocked it and heaved it open. Glockter stepped awkwardly over a puddle that had built up in a rut in the ground, cursing as his coat trailed in the foul water. The hinges screamed again as Severard wrestled the heavy gate shut, forehead creasing with the effort. Then he lifted the hood on his lantern, lighting up a wide ornamental courtyard, choked with rubble and weeds and broken wood.
"And here we are," said Severard.
It must once have been a magnificent building in its way. How much would all those windows have cost? How much all that decorative stonework? Visitors must have been awed by its owner's wealth, if not his good taste. But no more. The windows were blinded with rotting boards, the swirls of masonry were choked with moss and caked with bird droppings. The thin layer of green marble on the pillars was cracked and flaking, exposing the rotten plaster underneath. All was crumbled, broken, and decayed. Fallen lumps of the facade were strewn everywhere, casting long shadows on the high walls of the yard. Half the head of a broken cherub stared mournfully up at Glockter as he limped past. He had been expecting some dingy warehouse, some dank cellar near the water.
"What is this place?"
he asked, staring up at the rotting palace.
"Some merchant built it years ago."
Severard kicked a lump of broken sculpture out of his way, and it clattered off into the darkness.
"A rich man, very rich. Wanted to live near his warehouses and his wolves, keep one eye on business."
He strolled up the cracked and mossy steps to the huge flaking front door.
"He thought the idea might catch on, but how could it? Who'd want to live round here if they didn't have to? Then he lost all his money, as merchants do. His creditors have had trouble finding a buyer."
Glockter stared at a broken fountain, leaning at an angle and half filled with stagnant water.
Hardly surprising.
Severard's lamp barely lit the cavernous space of the entrance hall. Two enormous, curved, slumping staircases loomed out of the gloom opposite them. A wide balcony ran around the walls at first floor level, but a great section of it had collapsed and crashed through the damp floorboards below, so that one of the stairways ended, amputated, hanging in the empty air. The damp floor was strewn with lumps of broken plaster, fallen roofing slates, shattered timbers, and a spattering of grey bird droppings. The night sky peered in through several yawning holes in the roof. Glockter could hear the vague sound of pigeons cooing in amongst the shadowy rafters, and somewhere the slow dripping of water.
What a place.
Glockter stifled a smile. It reminds me of myself in a way. We both were magnificent once, and we both have our best days far behind us.
It's big enough, wouldn't you say? Asked Severard, picking his way in amongst the rubble towards a yawning doorway under the broken staircase, his lamp casting strange slanting shadows as he moved.
Oh, I'd have thought so, unless we get more than 1,000 prisoners at once.
Glockter shuffled after him, leaning heavily on his cane, worried about his footing on the slimy floor.
I'll slip and fall right on my arse, right here in all this bird shit. That would be perfect.
The arch opened into a crumbling hall, rotten plaster falling away in sheets, showing the damp bricks beneath. Gloomy doorways passed by on either side.
The sort of place that would make a man nervous, if he was prone to nervousness. He might imagine unpleasant things in these chambers, just beyond the lamplight, and horrible acts taking place in the darkness.
He looked up at Severard, ambling jauntily along in front, tuneless whistling vaguely audible from behind his mask, and frowned.
But we are not prone to nervousness. Perhaps we are the unpleasant things. Perhaps the acts are ours.
How big is this place?
Asked Glockter as he hobbled along.
35 rooms. Not counting the servants' quarters.
A palace? How the hell did you find it?
I used to sleep here some nights, after my mother died. I found a way in. The roof was still mostly on back then, and it was a dry place to sleep. Dry and safe, more or less.
Ah, what a hard life it's been. Thug and torturer is a real step up for you, isn't it? Every man has his excuses. And the more vile the man becomes, the more touching the story has to be. What is my story now, I wonder?
Ever resourceful, eh, Severard?
That's what you pay me for, Inquisitor.
They passed into a wide space. A drawing room, a study, a ballroom even, it was big enough. Once beautiful panels were sagging from the walls, covered in mould and flaking gilt paint. Severard moved over to one, still attached, and pushed it firmly at one side. There was a soft click as it swung open, revealing a dark archway beyond.
A hidden door. How delightful. How sinister. How very appropriate.
This place is as full of surprises as you are, said Glockter, limping painfully towards the opening.
And you wouldn't believe the price I got.
We bought this?
Oh, no, I did, with Rue's money. And now I'm renting it to you.
Severard's eyes sparkled in the lamplight.
It's a gold mine.
Laughed Glockter as he shuffled carefully down the steps.
All this and a head for business, too. Perhaps I'll be working for Archlector Severard one of these days. Stranger things have happened.
Glockter's shadow loomed out ahead of him into the darkness as he labored crab-like down the steps, his right hand feeling out the gaps between the rough stone blocks to lend him some support.
"The cellars go on for miles," muttered Severard from behind. "We have our own private access to the canals, and to the sewers too, if you're interested in sewers."
They passed a dark opening on their left, then another on their right, always going slowly downwards.
"Frost tells me you can get all the way from here to the Agrion without once coming up for air."
"That could be useful."
"I'd say so, if you can stand the smell."
Severard's lamp found a heavy door with a small barred opening.
"Home again," he said, and gave 4 quick knocks.
A moment later, Practical Frost's masked face loomed abruptly out of the darkness at the little window.
"Only us."
The albino's eyes showed no sign of warmth or recognition.
"But then they never do."
Heavy bolts slid back on the other side of the door, and it swung smoothly open. There was a table and chair and fresh torches on the walls, but they were unlit. It must have been pitch black in here until our little lamp arrived.
Glockter looked over at the albino.
Have you just been sitting here in the dark?
The hulking practical shrugged, and Glockter shook his head.
Sometimes I worry about you, Practical Frost. I really do.
He's down here, said Severard, ambling off down the hall, heels making clicking echoes on the stone flags of the floor. This must once have been a wine cellar. There were several barrel-vaulted chambers leading off to either side, sealed with heavy gratings.
Glockter!
Salem Rue's fingers were gripped tightly round the bars, his face pressed up between them. Glockter stopped in front of the cell and rested his throbbing leg.
Ruth, how are you? I hardly expected to see you again so soon.
He had lost weight already. His skin was slack and pale, still marked with fading bruises.
He does not look well, not well at all.
What's happening, Glockter? Please, why am I here?
Well, where's the harm?
It seems the Archlector still has a use for you. He wants you to give evidence.
Glockter leaned towards the bars. Before the Open Council, he whispered.
Ruse grew paler still.
Then what?
We'll see. Angland, Ruse, Angland.
What if I refuse?
Refuse the Archlector?
Glockter chuckled.
No, 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 Ruse. You don't want to do a thing like that.
He turned away and shuffled after Severard.
For pity's sake, it's dark down here.
You'll get used to it, Glockter called over his shoulder. Amazing. What one can get used to.
The last of the chambers held their latest prisoner. Chained up to a bracket in the wall, naked and bagged, of course. He was short and stocky, tending slightly to fat, with fresh grazes on his knees, no doubt from being flung into the rough stone cell.
So, this is our killer, eh?
The man rolled himself up onto his knees when he heard Glockter's voice straining forward against his chains. A little blood had soaked through the front of the bag and dried there, making a brown stain on the canvas.
A very unsavory character indeed, said Severard. Doesn't look too fearsome now, though, does he?
They never do, once they're brought to this. Where do we work?
Severard's eyes smiled even more.
Oh, you're going to like this, Inquisitor.
It's a touch theatrical, said Glockter, but none the worse for that.
The room was large and circular with a domed ceiling, painted with a curious mural that ran all the way round the curved walls. The body of a man lay on the grass, bleeding from many wounds, with a forest behind him. 11 other figures walked away, 6 on one side, 5 on the other, painted in profile, awkwardly posed, dressed in white, but their features indistinct. They faced another man, arms stretched out, all in black and with a sea of colourfully daubed fire behind him. The harsh light from 6 bright lamps didn't make the work look any better.
Hardly of the highest quality, more decoration than art. But the effect is quite striking, nonetheless.
No idea what it's supposed to be, said Severard.
The Master Maker,
mumbled Practical Frost.
Of course, said Glockter, staring up at the dark figure on the wall and the flames behind. You should study your history, Practical Severard. This is the Master Maker Canadius.
He turned and pointed to the dying man on the opposite wall.
And this is Great Juvens, whom he has killed.
He swept his hand over the figures in white.
And these are Juvens' apprentices, the Magi marching to avenge him.
Ghost stories fit to scare children with.
What kind of man pays to have shit like this on the walls of his cellar?
Asked Severard, shaking his head. Oh, this sort of thing was quite popular at one time. There's a room painted like this in the palace. This is a copy, and a cheap one. Glockter looked up at the shadowed face of Canadius, staring grimly down into the room, and the bleeding corpse on the opposite wall. Still, there's something quite unsettling about it, isn't there? Or there would be, if I gave a damn. Blood, fire, death, vengeance. No idea why you'd want it in the cellar. Perhaps there was something dark about our friend the merchant.
There's always something dark about a man with money, said Severard. Who are these two?
Glockter frowned, peering forward. Two small, vague figures could be seen under the arms of the Maker, one on each side.
Who knows? Asked Glockter. Maybe they're his practicals.
Severard laughed. A vague exhalation of air even came from behind Frost's mask, though his eyes showed no sign of amusement.
My, my, he must be thoroughly tickled.
Glockter shuffled toward the table in the center of the room. Two chairs faced each other across the smooth, polished surface. One was a spare, hard affair of the sort you found in the cellars of the House of Questions, but the other was altogether more impressive, throne-like almost, with sweeping arms and a high back, upholstered in brown leather. Glockter placed his cane against the table and lowered himself carefully, back aching.
"Oh, this is an excellent chair," he breathed, sinking slowly back into the soft leather, stretching out his leg, throbbing from the long walk here.
There was a slight resistance. He looked beneath the table. There was a matching footstool there. Glockter tipped his head back and laughed.
"Oh, this is fine. You shouldn't have."
He settled his leg down on the stool with a comfortable sigh.
"It was the least we could do," said Severard, folding his arms and leaning against the wall next to the bleeding body of Juvens. "We did well from your friend Rose. Very well. You've always seen us right, and we don't forget that."
"Hmm,"
said Frost, nodding his head.
"You spoil me."
Glockter stroked the polished wood on the arm of the chair.
"My boys, where would I be without you? Back home in bed with Mother fussing over me, I suppose, wondering how she'll ever find a nice girl to marry me now."
He glanced over the instruments on the table. His case was there, of course, and a few other things, well used, but still highly serviceable. A pair of long-handled tongs particularly caught his eye. He glanced up at Severard.
"Teeth?"
"Seemed a good place to start."
"Fair enough."
Glockter licked at his own empty gums, then cracked his knuckles one by one.
"Teeth it is."
As soon as the gag was off, the assassin started screaming at them in Styrian, spitting and cursing, struggling pointlessly at his chains. Glockter didn't understand a word of it.
"But I think I catch the meaning, more or less. Something very offensive indeed, I imagine. Something about our mothers and so on. But I am not easily offended."
He was a rough-looking sort, face pockmarked with acne scars, nose broken more than once, and bent out of shape.
"How disappointing. I was hoping the mercers might have gone up market on this occasion at least. But that's merchants for you, always looking for the bargain."
Practical Frost ended the torrent of unintelligible abuse by punching the man heavily in the stomach.
"That'll take his breath away for a moment, long enough to get the first word in."
"Now then," said Glockter, "we'll have none of that nonsense here. We know you're a professional, sent to blend in and do a job. You wouldn't blend in too well if you couldn't even speak the language, now would you?"
The prisoner had got his breath back.
"Books on all of you, you bastards!" he gasped.
"Excellent. The common tongue will do nicely for our little chats. I have a feeling we may end up having several. Is there anything you would like to know about us before we begin, or shall we get straight to it?"
The prisoner stared up suspiciously at the painted figure of the Master Maker looming over Glockta's head.
Where am I?
We're just off the middle way, down near the water.
Glockta winced as the muscles in his leg suddenly convulsed. He stretched it out cautiously, waiting until he heard the knee click before he carried on.
You know, the middle way is one of the very arteries of the city. It runs straight through its heart from the Agrion to the sea. It passes through many different districts, has all manner of notable buildings. Some of the most fashionable addresses in the whole city are just up the lane. To me, though, it's nothing but a road between two dentists.
The prisoner's eyes narrowed, then darted over the instruments on the table.
But no more cursing. It seems the mention of dentistry has got his attention. Up at the other end of the avenue, and Glockta pointed roughly northwards, in one of the most expensive parts of town, opposite the public gardens, in a beautiful white house in the very shadow of the Agrionth, is the establishment of Master Farad. You might have heard of him.
Get fucked!
Glockta raised his eyebrows.
If only. They say that Master Farad is the finest dentist in the world. I believe he came from Gurkul originally, but he escaped the tyranny of the Emperor to join us in the Union and make a better life for himself, saving our wealthiest citizens from the terrors of bad teeth. When I came back from my own little visit to the South, my family sent me to him to see if there was anything he could do for me.
Glockta smiled wide, showing the assassin the nature of the problem.
Of course, there wasn't. The Emperor's torturers thought of that. But he's a damn fine dentist. Everyone says so.
So what?
Glockta let his smile fade.
Down at the other end of the middle way, down near the sea, in amongst the filth and the scum and the slime of the docks, am I. The rent may be cheap hereabouts, but I feel confident that once we have spent some time together, you will not think me any less talented than the esteemed Master Farad. It is simply that my talents lie in a different direction. The good master eases the pain of his patients, while I am a dentist,
and Glockta leaned slowly forward,
of a different sort.
The assassin laughed in his face.
Do you think you can scare me with a bag on the head and a nasty painting?
He looked round at Frost and Severard.
You crowd of freaks!
Do I think we scare you, the three of us?
Glockta allowed himself a chuckle at that.
Here you sit, alone, unarmed and thoroughly restrained. Who knows where you are but us? Or cares to know. You have no hope of deliverance or of escape. We're all professionals here. I think you can guess what's coming, more or less.
Glockta grinned a sickly grin.
Of course we scare you. Don't play the fool. You hide it well, I'll admit, but that can't last. The time will come soon enough when you'll be begging to go back in the bag.
You'll get nothing from me,
growled the assassin, staring him straight in the eye.
Nothing.
Tough. A tough man. But it's easy to act tough before the work begins. I should know.
Glockta rubbed his leg gently. The blood was flowing nicely now, the pain almost gone.
We'll keep it simple to begin with. Names. That's all I want for now. Just names. Why don't we start with yours? At least you can't tell us you don't know the answer.
They waited. Severard and Frost stared down at the prisoner, the green eyes smiling, the pink ones not. Silence. Glockta sighed.
Right then.
Frost planted his fists on either side of the assassin's jaw, started to squeeze until his teeth were forced apart. Severard shoved the ends of the tongs in between and forced his jaws open, much too wide for comfort. The assassin's eyes bulged.
Hurts, doesn't it? But that's nothing, believe me.